This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
What up? It's The Crossover Pod. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. And yeah, I just did my old podcast intro. What can I say? I kind of missed it. My usual tag team partner, Chris Mannix, is out this week. So I'm like Russell Westbrook in 2016. Now I do what I want. So what I wanted to do today is talk to my good friend Michael Lee of The Washington Post. Michael, welcome. We're both in new gigs since the last time we potted.
Yeah, and we're not talking All-Star Weekend, which is what we always do. So it's a little break from the norm, but I'm glad I get a chance to hang out with you in new locales and on a new day.
Indeed. Appreciate you joining us. And our All-Star, I hadn't even thought of this. Among the various tentpole events that will be falling away, you and I have a standing date at All-Star Weekend to wrap it up, to do a podcast on the Sunday night of All-Star Weekend. I guess we probably will not. If we did that at all, I guess it would be probably like this over Zoom. We will not be anywhere.
yes, no. I'm kind of, for the sake of COVID and the health of the players, I'm hoping that there is no All-Star pod.
Yes, agreed. I'm totally fine with us, of course, having the voting, which begins today, actually.
Yes.
We should have All-Star. We should have all-stars. We should not have an all-star game. I hope the NBA does not attempt to pull this off.
Yes, just let the players get the all-star recognition and the salary bonuses, and we'll all be merry and move on.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen. So this, we're taping this on Thursday. It's been a couple days since the one-year anniversary of Kobe's passing. I want to get to that later. I want to talk about our good friend Sekou Smith, who we, of course, lost this week. But before that, I want to talk about just some of what we've seen so far in the first quarter of the season, because we're right around the quarter mark of this weird 72-game, if they get to 72 games, season. But let's start with last night, because in your city, the defending champions visited, and the Lakers and Sixers played a really, really great game. Fun game, thrilling game, great finish. Sixers pull it out at the end, 107-106. Big shot by Tobias Harris to clinch that with 2.5 seconds left. Did we just see an NBA Finals preview last night?
I don't know. I mean, I say that just not because I don't know about basketball. I say that, and then I don't know if we're going to have a Finals, and I don't know who's going to get there, because I feel like the NBA in this whole season is just – is fighting another force that's just they can't control. And you've seen it with all the games that have been postponed and all the players who've missed games because of COVID protocols and players who've actually, been found tested positive for coronavirus. So it's really hard to say who's going to be there. I still feel like in terms of the best team in the East, I'm giving Brooklyn a little time to figure it out. Maybe they could get a big man off of the waiver wire or something to help out, on the interior. I think they have the most talent, the top-heavy talent. I think Philadelphia still has some questions about how players are going to respond under real pressure situations in the postseason, which is something that they haven't proven that they can do just yet. So I'm not ready to declare that NBA Finals preview. The only team I would just pencil in for sure, at least for right now, is the Lakers, because I just feel like it's just been incredible to see how they only had a 71-game layoff. They look like they're on cruise control, and they've been dominant. Like, nobody is, like, they're not even breaking a sweat, and they got the best record in the league. And I just think that that's just – it says a lot about the greatness of their two stars, but also the pieces that they picked up in the offseason. The acquisition of Marcus Gasol just fits in. He doesn't play a lot of minutes, but he's just the perfect, big man for LeBron. Dennis Schroeder is a really great acquisition, because the one thing you have to do when you play with LeBron is you got to be fearless. And you also got to have an attitude of like, I don't give a, what. And that's what Dennis Schroeder has. That's why he's been an annoying pest at every stop in his career.
Sometimes to his own team.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's why he's bouncing around right now, because he's like, if the ball's in my hand, I feel like I have an advantage. I'm going to take it. And you got to have that mindset, because it's easy to, when you play with LeBron or even an AD, to just stand and watch and just be in awe of their greatness. And a lot of times that puts a lot of pressure on them to have to play above and beyond what they may want to that night. Schroeder's going to be able to step in and give them a lot. So they look like they're ready to just kind of cruise on to going back to back. The only thing I think that can stand in their way is injuries or, you know, the boogeyman that's been haunting all of us for the last 12 months or so.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said on the Lakers, for sure. And Schroeder, I mean, some big moments last night, not just shots, but like, he completely snuffed out Danny Green, you know, on that corner three attempt. Now they end up getting the ball back and they, you know, Tobias hits the winning shot. But like, Schroeder just, you know, balling out defensively too, like at a critical moment there. So
And he set the big screen to get AD open for that layup, which is kind of funny though, because I'm thinking Danny Green was with the Lakers all last year. He knows what Anthony Davis's favorite play is. Like, you this caught you by surprise that they were going to run it. They actually ran it on Danny Green too, which was hilarious. Like, he'd be the one guy who'd say, "Oh, I'm going to bust this play up." But no, let's let Anthony Davis just walk in for an easy layup off the screen. So I thought that was pretty funny too, just the fact that, like, Danny, like, you've seen this play. Like, you should have seen it coming. And they still were able to exploit him.
I'm with you on doubts about the Sixers. I'm cautious at best about the Nets. I don't know what to make of them, Michael.
Yeah, it's hard.
They're right. They use the right words. Like, top heavy. They're very, very top heavy. And all that depth. Like, coming into the season, we thought if KD is KD, turns out he is.
Yes.
If KD is KD and Kyrie and KD click, they were. And this team has this phenomenal depth. Spencer Dinwiddie and Caris LeVert and Jared Allen and Joe Harris and all these guys. And suddenly, you know, no Dinwiddie because of injury. And everybody else, all the depth went out the door to get James Harden. And I get it. And they absolutely have the most potent threesome in the league. And one of the most potent trios we've ever seen, period, offensively. But, yeah, defense is clearly an issue.
By the way, shout out to Sean Powell for coming up with the great nickname for Brooklyn's team.
I missed that. What'd he give him?
The Notorious B.I.G. 3.
That's pretty good.
I got to give it up. That's pretty good.
That is very good. In fact, I don't expect the Nets are going to be using that marketing campaign anytime soon. But who knows? Maybe they'd embrace it. I mean,
they had Biggie jerseys. They had Bed-Stuy jerseys. I mean, why not?
Well, no doubt, and the Nets do love to pump the Biggie in the arena, but they don't like the idea that they would actually cop to the fact that they have three notorious stars that these guys are kind of like not exactly universally embraced. I'm not sure if they'll they should lean into that at this point.
Lean into it. The villainy is what excels. I mean, the two most annoying or appealing storylines of the year involved James Harden and Kyrie Irving, and now they're teammates. And I just think that just sort of adds to it. I mean, neither one of them wants to be a villain or anything. They're not that they've done anything bad. Yeah. But I think that for a lot of fans, just you had a lot of eye rolling whenever you saw like James doing something that, you know, like he's begging to get traded, or Kyrie, you just didn't understand what was happening with him. And he didn't really spend a lot of time trying to explain it to us, and he didn't have to. But I love that nickname. But I'll let you finish.
No, I was just going to say, like, they're polarizing. I don't know how much, like, Notorious might be a little, like, a step too far, but if they're going to lean into the villainy, you might as well go that way. The polarizing B.I.G. just doesn't have the same ring to it. So.
No, it doesn't, because they didn't go double platinum.
But I, you know, I'm intrigued by them. I've enjoyed watching them. I've enjoyed, aside from last night when Harden went off, I've enjoyed seeing Harden answer the question that I have posed rhetorically, that I think people around the league have posed for a while, which is, can James Harden do it another way? Is he willing to adapt? Is he willing to evolve? Can he be more facilitator than scorer? Does he have to dominate the offense the way that we saw the last several years in Houston? And so far, the answer is Yeah, he can evolve, and no, he doesn't need to dominate to be happy. Now, it's a short stretch. It's early with these three, and they haven't, the three of them together, you have not played a ton of minutes yet because Kyrie was out. KD skipped a game for rest purposes. There's a long way to go.
Well, one thing about the James Harden that I think that's sort of become evident to me is now that I look at him and I see him in Brooklyn, I think the main reason he went out of Houston is because he doesn't want to do it anymore. He doesn't want to be the only guy that could carry a franchise because he understands the limitations of his talents. Like he can't take a team to a championship by himself. And he can't do it as the main guy. He needs a guy who's better than him to be that front guy, and he can sort of buffer him and be great, but the pressure doesn't have to, you know, fall on him. And he's got the perfect guy in KD who, you know, has come back from an Achilles injury. Like he just picked up right where he left off from the you know, when he playing the Clippers, you know, in that series against with the Warriors. I mean, he's just really just an elite scorer. I mean, he's still trying to find his rhythm, and I think there's still a lot of areas that he can still improve. That's the scary thing. He's averaging 30, and he's not even, like, in shape yet, you know. So I think that's been really impressive. But I think James is actually sort of going back to that OKC role in some ways where he was a facilitator and just let, you know, Russell and KD kind of do their thing, and he just sort of, you know, filled in the gaps. And I think, you know, those losses against Cleveland were pretty ugly, but I think in some ways it was James just sort of figuring out, like, how am I going to fit in and how am I going to make this work? Because, you know, if you play with Kyrie, he's never going to see himself as a third option under any circumstance. Even if that's how they try to organize it or set it up, he will bust that through and say, no, I'm the man, no matter what, because that's his mindset. But everybody knows that KD is the man. So that means that everyone's like, is Kyrie going to take a back seat? I was like, no, he's not. James is going to have to be the guy, not necessarily take a back seat, but to be that facilitator, because he is a natural playmaker. He's a great passer. I go back to just what he did when he was with Team USA, and he actually played with Kyrie on that World Cup team in 2014. You know, he was a leader on that team, but he also was able to, you know, have big scoring bursts, but also step back and let other guys shine when opportunity came. So I think he kind of wants to be in that role. He wants to be in a position where it's not all on him. And he knew that going into the season in Houston, that it was going to be all on him, that he was going to have to go out and try to average 35 a game. I mean, we got so spoiled by the fact that he could do it that no one and everybody just said, oh, we can't get it done in the playoffs. I mean, it's hard to average 35 points a game. I mean, and he had like that, those 30 game scoring streaks and all these things. And I think we really took it for granted that he was putting up these big numbers. But that wears you out, especially when you don't see any kind of reward for it in the end. So I think in a lot of ways, even though he was a jerk on the way out of Houston, I think it was him just sort of accepting the fact that he can't do it like he used to do it.
There's, you know, two things that happened there in Houston that I think, you know, were instructive, or the things that I always looked at, which was, is he doing all this because he absolutely has to? I think it's questionable whether he had to go to the extremes that he did. Nevertheless, they won a lot of games that way. What was the cost? You know, the earlier years of his Houston run, when he flamed out, it was, is James tired? Is he fatigued? Did he do too much during the regular season? Then eventually it was, well, we got him help. We got Chris Paul, and then we got him Russell Westbrook. And so then it was, well, maybe he's just not built for those moments, or maybe it's because defenses can key in so much more on him in a series, which I think is a large part of this. No matter which of those explanations it is, to me, it pointed to the idea that there's a limit to how far you can go with a Harden-centric offense, at least to that extreme. And so, if, you know, look, if it's about fatigue, we don't have to worry about that anymore, because Harden in Brooklyn has two other elite offensive players to lean on, right? He does not have to overdo it, and so far he's not. If it's about not being able to rise to the big moments, and actually, you know, that's something that even started in the 2012 finals, right?
Right.
He flamed out against the Heat.
Miami Heat. Yeah.
That's a long time ago. He was a sixth man, but still, he had a very, very bad finals. He can lean on Durant and Kyrie, so that part there's no longer any worry. So, The real question is just simply like, is James Harden comfortable being this guy? Well, you know, is he going to average like 15 and 15 now? You know, I don't know if he's going to actually average 15 assists. He could.
If he averages 15 and 15, they won't win. I don't believe he's going to have nice. Like
maybe it's a little extreme.
But I mean, in terms
20
of,
points instead of 35.
He's going to have to be a 20-point scorer.
Yeah. 20 points instead of 35. Well, because, you know, KD and Kyrie can do a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah.
You don't
surrender that kind of depth just to get a 15-point score. Otherwise,
I'm getting a little too cute there.
No.
I was thinking, like, you know, when Steve Nash won back-to-back MVP, like, he was averaging, what, 16, 17 18. Points those seasons?
Yeah, his second year he won 18 and 11.
Yeah.
I remember that because that was the year Kobe averaged 35.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, everybody, Kobe's averaging 35 a game. There's only, like, five guys in NBA history who've done this. Like, give him his prof. But
I was at the Times at that point, at the New York Times at that point, where we were not allowed to vote. So I take no responsibility for the still sort of simmering controversy about Nash versus Kobe for MVP that year. Were you at the Post then?
I was at the Post, and I wrote like a very, very lengthy argument that Kobe was the MVP. And the main reason I said it is because I said something like to the effect that 10 years from now, no one will remember a single game Steve Nash played. But everyone will remember the defining moment of the 2005-06 season. Huh. Just finished talking about it. We talk about it every year because the man scored 81 points. And it's still amazing to me that, like, he scored 81 and people were like, I don't know if he's MVP. Like, did you see that Lakers team? Like, it wasn't like he scored 81 because he just wanted to just see what he could do. He had to get 81 because that team stunk. And he was able to get into the playoffs. But one last thing about the Nets, though. I think that the best thing about the unsuspecting benefit of James Harden being a complete, pain in the rear is that he may have saved Caris LeVert's life. I still marvel at the fact that, you know, he gets traded and, you know, to Houston first and then winds up getting traded to Indiana. And they find a cancerous, you know, growth on his liver. Was it liver or kidney? Kidney.
Right?
Yeah. That, to me, I don't know how that was missed, first off. But he's got to just be, like, going from, like, the disappointment of, like, I'm not going to be with this fun team that I've been with my whole career to, like, wow, I get to live because I got traded. You don't see that happen too often in the situation. So I'm a big Caris LeVert fan. I like his game a lot. I thought he really was coming on strong last year in the absence of KD and Kyrie. And I thought he was great in that playoff series against Philadelphia 2 years ago. So I'm rooting for him. I want to see him do well. But I just find it amazing that trade may be what allows him to have a really long and kind of prosperous career.
It is stunning. And my first thought too, Michael, was what you said, which is how does this not get caught sooner? But I don't think they, whatever physical exams guys go through each season as they return to their teams, I don't think it's maybe to the same extent as you do when you're going for, when you've been traded and the new team has to do a full evaluation. I mean, I don't know the exact details there, but I suspect that it's a little bit different level of exam. And who knows what, you know, might, you know, this is, you know, where we veer into, we should not play doctor on podcasts
exactly.
territory, but
yeah.
I do wonder just the time difference, right? Was whatever growth that they were able to detect now, would it not have been detectable 4 or 5 months ago or something?
Who knows? Yeah.
But it is remarkable. It reminds me of when the Knicks acquired Katino Mobley years ago. You remember this? They ended up screening him. That was in the wake of Eddie Curry and all these other heart concerns across the league, where some things had, you know, gone undetected. Jason Collier, right, in Atlanta.
Yeah, Jason Collier,
who had died from a heart concern. And so Katino Mobley, they found to have, I think it was hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which was the same thing that Curry had had, and they decided he should retire, or he decided he should retire. Then later he changed his mind and I think sued them. But it was a similar kind of thing where the trade revealed through a physical exam that you've got this condition you weren't aware of. It does
Did
not happen
to Sean Elliott too?
Way back in the day. Yeah, I think
Detroit so. San Antonio.
Yeah. Anyway, agree with you on Caris LeVert. Really promising young player. Sad for him that he's not playing right now. Happy for him that this was found. Hopefully, we see him back on a court soon. All right, so let's jump from the Nets back to the Sixers and last night's game for a minute, because I always thought, as the trade rumors were cranking up in the weeks leading up to the Harden deal, that the best fit for him was in fact Philly. And I think, Michael, last night's game kind of underscored why that is. So Tobias Harris hits the game winner. Yep. But let's reel back or rewind for a minute here. The Sixers had a lead 105-104 with about a minute to go. Ben Simmons gets the ball across midcourt, and he's got Schroeder guarding him. He stops his drive at the arc and flips the ball back to Embiid at the arc. Embiid has a moment there where he's open for a three. Like, he could have shot the three. He had plenty of distance between him and Anthony Davis. He pump faked, but I think it's because he hesitated and then he faked to cover for it. He drives on Anthony Davis. He misses a mid-range shot. That could have been curtains for them. But Danny Green gets the rebound, and Doris Burke on the broadcast is immediately saying, why wasn't Embiid in the post instead of up at the arc? Ball gets back to Simmons. He does not try to drive on LeBron, which somewhat justifiable, but nobody came to set a screen either. And he just throws this pass to Danny Green in the corner, who's well guarded by Schroeder. Danny Green misses the three. Doris, again, right on top of it, says, quote, that's just an awful end of game possession right there by the Sixers, which it is. So here's the problem. Ben Simmons, not a go-to guy in those moments because he doesn't shoot, because he doesn't necessarily have all the mid-range weapons either, but he's certainly a potent weapon on the drive, and he didn't even try to drive. Embiid, who's your best player, was not in the post, and even if he were, you can get doubled in the post, and that could, you know, easily just snuff out the whole possession right there. You want a go-to guy in those moments who can create for himself or for a teammate. And neither of those guys, Simmons is a creator, but in that situation, because of his lack of jump shot and just his hesitation and his unwillingness to get fouled because he doesn't shoot free throws well, suddenly your two best players are not part of this. And Tobias Harris hits the game winner. And okay, well, that's fine. You won that game. But when it comes to the postseason, and you raised the concerns earlier when I said, was this a finals preview? That's part of why we still have doubts about this team. Who is their go-to guy in the clutch? Because the championship teams usually have at least one of those guys that is very identifiable. And if the answer is Tobias Harris, okay, maybe. If it's Simmons or Embiid, I think we just saw last night in those moments, they're either passing up shots or taking a bad shot.
Yeah, the one thing that I feel like is holding back Ben Simmons from being truly great and the Sixers from being a true championship contender is that he's got to not be scared. He's got to be a lot more fearless. He's got to be somebody who isn't afraid of how it's going to look. I always feel like one of the issues I always have with Ben Simmons is that he's too cool for school. He always is concerned about how he's perceived, and he's always concerned about how it's going to look. I think that's one of the reasons why he refuses to shoot threes, because he doesn't want to embarrass himself by missing the shot and having people talk about the fact that he can't shoot. I think it's a mental thing that he's blocked himself from actually achieving the level of greatness that he probably has in him. Because I think everybody knows that he has these great physical tools. You know, he's a great defensive player. He can pass. He can make excellent passes. He can create for others. He can facilitate. He can get to the basket at will. But he just, for whatever reason, he denies himself of what he could possibly be. And I know Brett Brown tried to get, you know, him to shoot threes last year, and I never thought it was about threes. I just felt like he's not helping the Sixers if he doesn't, you know, if you have the ball in your hands, that means you're facing the basket. And if you are facing the basket and you're not determined to shoot at it, you are a liability to your team. And I think that's one of the things that Ben has been. But one of the things is he's just got to get – he's got to make mistakes. He's got to have – a couple of 10 turnover games, like just be over aggressive, just go all out. And I think that if he stretches himself out and fails a little bit and then understands just how far he can go, I think then he'll figure out who he really is. And I think a lot of people, I say, well, Ben hasn't gotten better since his rookie year, and he's the same player that he always was. I haven't seen him, you know, take the next step. I think he's standing in his own way. I think it's time for him to stop worrying about being cool. Stop worrying about, you know, what people are going to say. Shoot a couple airball threes if you have to. Shoot a couple airball jumpers if you have to. If that's what it's going to take for you to take the, shot and be aggressive and be assertive, then that's what's going to happen. And I think that his teammates will live with it. And I think they want that. They want to encourage that because they know that he has it in him to be a truly great player. But if you're not ever going to take chances and try to really, you know, stretch yourself out, you're holding us all back. And that's why I do have problems seeing as a contender, you know, like a team that can actually win a championship. Cause I do want to see Ben do that. I do want to see Ben take more chances. Cause I think that once he does and succeeds with those chances, then his confidence will go up and so will his confidence of his team.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's funny. We've, you know, just spent a few days this week, again, reflecting on Kobe and what he meant. And we'll get to that a little later in the pod, but, you know, one of the defining moments of Kobe's early career is as a rookie missing all those shots, airballing those shots against Utah in the playoffs, no less, with a really talented team around him.
Yes.
And, you know,
and I was a Lakers fan then, and I was very mad at him for doing that. I was like, why isn't he getting the ball to Eddie Jones?
That's what you have to do as a star or as an up and coming star, right? You have to have those moments where you put it on the line, you're willing to do it, you take the backlash, you take Michael Lee being mad at you as a Laker fan, you get over it. Michael will get over it. And you have to have those failures. Michael Jordan had to have those failures. LeBron had to have those, like all the greats, Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, everybody has to go through that at some point. And if you don't even take the chances, and that's what it feels like with Ben Simmons, I think you nailed it. Like it's like he doesn't want to put himself in that position so he can still have the fairly clean stat line that says, well, I had a triple double. I did my part and I defended my ass off, and he does. And that's really important too. But you're the guy with the ball in your hands. You are the team's main ball handler, creator, playmaker. The responsibility that goes with that is huge.
Yeah. I remember last year, Elton Brand had made a point that, you know, one of the things that he's talked to Ben about was that, like, he always wants to make the right play and that he trusts that his teammate will make the open shot if he gets it for him than if he takes the jumper. And I'm like, well, that's fine and dandy, but if you're one of the best players on the team, then you got to say, I'm the best option here. Like, I am the best option here, and have confidence in your own ability. And I'm not sure if it's there. Maybe that's what's holding. Maybe he's just not confident. Yeah. But even still, he won't ever get that confidence if he doesn't try.
And this is why I thought James Harden for Ben Simmons made a world of sense.
Yeah,
so.
It absolutely did. And, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I will give Tobias Harris credit.
Yes.
His reunion with Doc Rivers has turned out to be just exactly what he needed, because he looked completely lost last year and he never really found a rhythm or looked comfortable. But right now you can see that he's playing with confidence and he took that shot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's willing. Says a lot. You got to be willing to step up on the situations. You're not always going to make it, but you also got to want to, we also got to want it.
Yeah. Should LeBron have been tossed for that flagrant on Embiid?
He should have been tossed. I was shocked that he was allowed to play basketball after that. I mean, that was pretty egregious, man. Like, I mean, we're lucky that Embiid didn't get hurt, but like, that was not a basketball play. I mean, he didn't make a play at the ball at all. A guy's in the air. I mean, he knows better. Like, that was disappointing for me to see him do that, because I swear if it was the other way around and somebody shoved LeBron midair like that, oh, that guy would have been ejected and suspended the next game. And if he wasn't, LeBron would have made sure of it. He would have been lobbying the league right after that to say, hey, there's no place for that in our game. And there is no place for that in our game. Like, he didn't have to foul Embiid like that. And Embiid's known to embellish. He's known to kind of, you know, add a little bit to it.
Yeah.
But that was legit. He got shoved, man, in midair. You don't ever want to see that, especially with a great player like that.
Not to mention, remember, Joel Embiid came into this league not with just the foot problems. He had back problems
Yes.
Coming into the league. So when he hits and he's immediately reaching for his back and he's wincing that hard, and I'm like, oh shit, like this could be serious. And you know, look, we're taping this in the morning on Thursday. We haven't heard anything yet from Sixers, you know, Central about whether or not there are any after effects today. Hopefully he's just really sore and it'll work itself out and it's nothing serious. And I'm not trying to raise any, you know, flags that it could be. But in the moment, that was my first thought, Michael. It immediately went back to, this is a guy who's a big man with back problems, or at least a history of back problems prior to coming to the NBA. And so, and I think he had back surgery, right? Before he entered the league?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he had a disc at Kansas. That was one of the reasons why he slipped in the draft, because he had a foot and the back.
So that's worrisome. I thought, you know, initially, so depending on the angle on that replay, there was one angle where I thought LeBron was just keeping him from falling on him, right? This huge human being is in the air rising up over you. And I thought for a minute, like LeBron was just kind of putting his hands up to protect himself. But there's a different angle where you see there's certainly a shove.
There's a shove.
And that's a dangerous thing. No matter what size you are, if you are midair and somebody who is as strong as LeBron shoves you, you are not going to land gracefully.
Yeah. It's easy just to get out of the way if you don't want to get posterized, but like shoving a guy when he's defenseless. I thought that I was surprised that there wasn't like, it should have been a flagrant too, but maybe the league will upgrade it after the fact that if I'm Philadelphia, I'm lobbying the league to try to at least, you know, acknowledge that that was something that we can't have, like you can't just do that. And so I was disappointed. I mean, it did take away from an otherwise entertaining game, and LeBron made some great passes at the end of the game. So it's good that I guess he was on there in that respect. But in the other, I mean, that has to be something that's just not acceptable no matter who you are.
So here at the quarter-ish mark of the season, Embiid, this is according to Basketball References Awards Tracker, which does probabilities based on what the makeup of previous MVPs has been, and they create an algorithm out of that. Joel Embiid right now is second in the running according to their formula for MVP at 12.2% probability. Nikola Jokic is the runaway winner at 47%, and LeBron is fourth at 8.7% behind Kawhi. But I kind of feel like at the quarter mark, LeBron and Embiid are maybe the two front runners to me, in part because what this formula does not seem to take into account as much is record.
And,
but then, you know, the Nuggets, like a week ago, I would have said Jokic isn't even on my radar because I'm a stickler about you got to be top two or three in your conference. You got to be a serious contender. And the Nuggets were kind of flagging for a while there, but they're 11-7 now. They've kind of righted themselves. I think they ultimately will be, you know, top three or four in the West. I think they're right around there now anyway. And Kawhi and Paul George are going to be detracting from each other, I think. And KD is in this conversation for sure, but it's going to be difficult to parse out with three stars there. I think LeBron and Embiid, I think we saw the two front runners last night.
Yeah, a couple things on that. Every name that you mentioned is a big. Like, I'm just thinking, I'm glad I don't vote. How are you going to select all NBA this year? Because you got Giannis, two-time MVP. You got LeBron. You got KD. You got Kawhi.
How about this? So to your
that's
point,
four guys. Right, this is here.
A great. You're making a great point. No, so this is all right. Again, the tracker is what it is. This is an algorithm, but still, this is how Basketball Reference has it. Jokic, of course, center. Embiid, center. Kawhi Leonard, forward. Centers. LeBron, forward. Durant, forward. Anthony Davis, forward/center. Giannis, forward. Rudy Gobert, center. There's your top eight according to the algorithm. all front court guys, and then Middleton is ninth. Middleton's not really an MVP candidate.
Guys are gonna have to like get a little tricky, maybe to just say, well, KD's just a big guard, you know.
For all NBA, you're right, man. Like, this is gonna be brutal.
It's gonna be tough. Somebody's gonna be really gonna be left off and have a legitimate gripe. But then again, who do you take off if you don't put them on there? It's gonna be tough.
Yeah.
As for MVP, you know, right now it's looking like LeBron. You know, the one thing I like about LeBron's season is that it's really understated. You know, last year I felt like he was trying to create the story, you know, the narrative that he would be the MVP. And like, he sort of had a media campaign, you know, all of his friends and buddies were, you know, kind of promoting him. And Even though Giannis was, to me, just the clear runaway without even, you know, I thought he was just, it was without debate that he was the MVP. But this year, LeBron is just going about his business. It's almost like he's on cruise control, and he's still just putting up these phenomenal numbers. I don't really even care about, like, what year it is in his career, you know, because I think we've gotten used to saying it. How is he doing it in year 15, 16, 17? Like, yeah, this is great. He's great. You know, he's greatness personified. And that's what I think is really amazing about this year, is that coming off that championship in the bubble with limited rest, he's playing every game. He's out there competing, and he's playing at a high level. And occasionally he'll give Cleveland 46 just because he can, you know. So, yeah, I mean, as long as the Lakers are winning and he's playing at this level, it'll be tough to deny him. I know we always want to, you know, pick, you know, somebody like a Jokic or an Embiid because, like, it seems like this is their time. But one thing we've seen from LeBron throughout his entire career, especially this last half of it, is that he's not willing to concede anything to anybody, and he still wants to be relevant. And but I think if his team is the best team in the league, and he's the reason they're at the top, then he's the MVP. And it's tough because you know, the way this whole season is set up with the first half and the second half, you don't really know how it's going to play out in the second half of the season. But for right now, at the quarter mark, I would go with LeBron.
I think I would too. And to your point about all the unknowns and, you know, like the second half of the season, we don't even have a schedule for yet.
Yeah.
We don't know how many games they're going to have to squeeze in. We don't know if we'll even actually get to 72. And the one thing we, you know, the one concern about LeBron that seemed most prominent coming into the season was, okay, the Lakers have the shortest turnaround in history, the Lakers and the Heat both. But for LeBron, especially, that's a concern given the age and the miles and everything else. But as LeBron is showing once again, age and miles are practically meaningless when it comes to him. But we say that now. Let's see where we are, you know, in another couple of months. You know, I hope he sustains this. You know, I want to see, yeah. I always say, I want to see the greats be as great as long as possible. So, but if there's no fatigue factor, if there's no payback that has to happen for the short turnaround and everything else, and he sustains this, and the Lakers finish with one of the top records in the league, and LeBron's putting up those kinds of numbers, like, what, you know, how would he not be? And it's not to say that these other candidates aren't going to be very strong and make it an argument, but
It's funny. I remember when I was first started covering the league, and I remember one of the line that we've used a lot, but I first heard it from Joe Dumars when he said, "Father's time is undefeated." Yeah. And it was like, oh, yeah. And somebody's like, yeah, if it wasn't, like, Will Chamberlain would still be out here dominating the league. Like, at some point, the game just fades you know, and leaves you. With LeBron, he obviously isn't the same player because now he's learned to, you know, become a marksman from three-point range. I mean, he's shooting, you know, 40% from long distance, which is not something that was a strength of his, you know, let's say 10 years ago, but now he's a guy that can step back and comfortably hit that shot. So he's able to compensate on whatever areas he may be lacking defensively, athletically, by, you know, changing his game and becoming, you know, that great facilitator, led the league in assists last year. He's just the great ability to adapt. And I think that the thing that makes him special and puts him in that conversation among the best to ever do it is that he just doesn't get hurt. I mean, he's a machine.
I'm knocking on my wood desk as you say this.
Yeah, I'm knocking right now too. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And I think about it all the time too. Where would he be on the all-time scoring list if his career didn't have so many lockouts and weird sort of seasons with bubbles and, you know, and all this other stuff? I mean, think about all the games that he's lost, not because he's hurt, yeah, but because the league was, you know, going through some issues, or we have a pandemic that's interrupting everything. I mean, because he's done everything right to stay on the floor. The only thing that's really kept him from being higher up than he already is that things out of his control.
Last thought on that, because you brought up the scoring leader thing, and then just, you know, there's going to be the chase for Kareem's record at some point in the not so distant future. There was a time maybe 5 years ago when we talked about whether Kareem's record could fall, and it was all about Kevin Durant, and there was somebody else who was possibly in the conversation. But like, we didn't think of LeBron that way, because even though he had put up the scoring numbers, we just didn't think. I think we didn't think there was enough time left, and he's never like chased scoring in the way that some of the all-time greats have. And so like the idea that LeBron, who comes into the league, I know people say it was like a fallacious concept that he was more Magic than Michael, but that was the discussion, was he was more of the facilitator, more of a pass first guy, and still a dominant scorer anyway. But because that's never been his pursuit or his defining trait as a star, I don't think we would have ever guessed. We certainly wouldn't have in his first couple of years, oh, this guy's going to one day challenge Kareem's scoring record. I mean, whereas Durant is just this pure scorer. And again, not that Durant doesn't do other things well. It's just that the way they're built, it's just different.
We would have that conversation with Durant if he hadn't broken his foot in 2004.
3 foot surgeries in 12 months or whatever it was.
Yeah, and he didn't have the ruptured Achilles. I mean, he'd already be in the top 15 right now. Yeah. Which is crazy, and he'd be, you know, closing in on the top 10. So, so he's lost pretty much two seasons, and he's still, he has over 23,000 points already. So it's pretty. He is an incredible scorer. So let's not deny that. Yeah. But LeBron is somebody that, he's gonna wind up maybe leading the league and score, be all time leading scorer and top five assist guy, which is just ridiculous.
If I told you in like 2010 or even 2015, LeBron James is going to get the all-time scoring record, he's going to pass Kareem, and he's going to do it in a Laker uniform.
Wow.
We would have just laughed. We would have thought, yeah, that's funny.
My head would have exploded.
Your head would have exploded. All right, we should wind down here with a couple things before we go. First, Kobe. So the one-year anniversary hit this week. A lot of excellent pieces have been written about it. And you know, the question that kept being asked of me when I was, you know, talking to folks the other day and radio and doing other stuff was, you know, what do we think a year later in terms of his meaning, his impact on the game, the lasting, just the lasting effects of Kobe. And it's not legacy in the basketball sense, but legacy in the broadest possible sense. And I do feel a little bit, not differently now than a year ago, but I think for me, a year of kind of absorbing that loss and how people respond to the loss has certainly shaped my view. So, but give me your impression, Michael. Where are we on Kobe a year later?
It's funny how the way that he was perceived, you know, at the end of his career, feels so much different than the way he's perceived now that he's gone. And I think a lot of that is that he's changed. He changed in a lot of ways over the last 4 years of his life. But he also, because he was willing to be that mentor for guys. You know, I remember doing a piece, I was at Yahoo about him being the godfather and just how so many players had leaned on him for advice. He influenced so many guys. I didn't necessarily see him as an influencer when he retired, because I thought he was just a one-off, right? He was the guy that spent a whole time, kind of trying to mimic Michael at first, and then he sort of became his own personality with the Mamba. But he was singular, and the game had changed so much as his career ended, where it wasn't just about that one star who just dominated and imposed his will on everybody else. It was more about ball movement and sort of a free-flowing super teams, all these other things that kind of distracted from just saying this, we were just going to give the ball to this one guy and just let him go to work. But he influenced all of these guys. They all idolized Kobe. They all looked up to Kobe. They all shot, balled up paper in the trash can and shouted his name, But when you look at, say, a Trae Young, Kyrie Irving, a Giannis, a Paul George, Devin Booker, all these players that DeMar DeRozan, players that he would reach out to, offer advice to, they would come to him and ask for advice. He wasn't necessarily a guy, while he was playing, willing to give up any secrets. He wasn't willing to, let anybody have that kind of edge, because he wanted to have that edge, because he wanted to dominate and be the man. So I think that just how giving he was to other players, just how much he embraced the women's game. I think that that to me it has been just the thing you have to applaud him for, by helping the WNBA, by helping NBA players truly respect, you know, their counterparts in the WNBA, making that orange sweatshirt popular, you know, before he passed. I think that, that's something that stands out to me too. I just feel like, you know, I don't even know if he was aware of how much he touched people, to this effect, you know. I think he knew he was great and that he had a great career and guys maybe wanted to idolize him, but I don't think he understood how far reaching it went and just how everybody seemed to have a Kobe story. Kobe was my hero story, yeah. Which I didn't anticipate when he retired, but we definitely know that's the case now.
So, and that was what hit me, Michael. Like you were saying, it's funny. You know, I don't think Kobe realized. I definitely didn't realize. Now, for Kobe not to realize it, it's understandable. He's Kobe. He is in his own world. He's just doing the thing, right?
Yeah.
Everybody else responds to it. When you are the star on stage, you don't necessarily know how far-reaching that is. You do your thing, and people respond, and you feel some bit of it, but you can't grasp the whole of it. And as the outsiders, as the observers, as journalists, our job is to contextualize it. And I covered him starting his second year in the league in 97, and I didn't get it. I swear to you, and maybe part of this is that I left LA in 2004 to come to New York and was not there for the second act of Kobe. I was there for those finals. I was there to see him win championships 4 and 5, but I wasn't immersed in LA anymore. And so, but even still,
I don't think you needed to be. I mean, everybody I just named, you know,
yeah.
None of those guys were Lakers, you know.
But it's also universal. Like it's global. It is what hit me over the course of those terrible few days as we were absorbing this a year ago, was to see that the tributes and the impromptu memorials and the thousands of people who were gathered in various places. It wasn't just LA where you know, obviously the streets were filled around Staples Center. You saw tributes and memorials and all these things from all around the world. Like Kobe's reach and the impact that he made was so much more extensive, so much more profound than I ever understood in the 20-something years, with the, you know, 7 years covering him as a beat writer, and then the 20-something years covering him overall. I don't think I understood or grasped just how beloved, because he was so polarizing too. And so part of it, you always think, oh, some love him, some hate him. But he moved people, Michael. Like he moved, and you know, you mentioned a bunch of the players who counted him as an inspiration. And I did a story earlier this week, it's on SI.com, about the impact of Kobe or the traits of Kobe that live on in today's league. That, you know, you can find his big moment mentality is Damian Lillard, and his blunt candor is Draymond Green. And I've picked some guys who I think were avatars of certain of Kobe's best traits. And Steph Curry is the WNBA advocate. But when I talked to Christian Wood, who kept invoking Mamba mentality on TNT recently when he had his post-game interview, Christian Wood's like Mamba mentality embodied, because he embraced that idea and got his career on track when it could have gone off track. So there's nothing about Christian Wood that screams Kobe Bryant, but the Mamba mentality part was something that resonated with him, and that when he finally understood it and how to embrace it himself and do it himself, it got his career on track. And so when I asked Christian, so how many people across the league do you think count Kobe as like their idol or inspiration or something? And he said 70-80%. And I don't even think it's an exaggeration. I truly think now that that is the full extent of Kobe's influence. We had a bunch of guys who grew up wanting to be like Mike, and guys who tried to emulate Michael Jordan. But I don't, even then, I don't think it was the same impact in terms of just the overall, and maybe it was. It's hard, you know, over time these things fade, but I feel like Kobe's impact on this generation and also well beyond the game is just incredibly profound. And that is something that over the last year is my biggest takeaway from all this and losing him and coming to grasp with all of that is there is a new appreciation, I think, for just how extensive his influence was.
Yeah, before we go, it just goes to show that we tell the stories, but we don't make them. You know, the yeah. fans, the players, they determine a person's legacy more than we think we do. You know, we can say, oh, he's better than him, he's better than him. But we're not the ones that really are determining it. You know, the people who, you know, fall in love with the game, you know, watching these guys play, they're the ones that tell the story at the end of the day.
You're absolutely, absolutely. I want to close with this. So on the day that we were all, you know, obviously contemplating Kobe and just the reliving a lot of the emotions, frankly, of a year ago. And it was, I think, a very somber day for everybody across the NBA, just hitting that 1 year mark. In the midst of all that, we get very, very tough news that our friend Sekou Smith from NBA.com and NBA TV had passed due to COVID. It hit all of us hard. I know it hit you really hard. I know you guys were tight. I'd known Sekou since his beat writer days for the Indianapolis Star covering the Pacers and all the way through when he was covering the Hawks, one of your former beats. And it's, you know, I still can't believe it. Sekou just 48. For the listeners who may not know as much about Sekou, the person, as well as the journalist, Michael, just give me your sense of the man and what we've lost.
Well, I think one of the things that became clear to me and that I knew, you know, but I didn't really know to this extent, there aren't many people in our business who get like 100% approval rating. Yes. But that's Sekou. He had an ability to connect with people in a way that I always marveled at. In some ways, I was envious of it because the way he could work a locker room, the way he could, you know, talk to players. Like, you know, when I first got started covering the NBA, you know, I try to keep a certain distance between me and the players, like, and how I spoke to them. And I, you know, but with Sekou, he treated everybody the same. It didn't matter if you were, you know, Larry Bird or Mike Woodson or whoever he was covering, he talked to you the same exact way he talked to me, you know? And that meant that he made fun of your outfit. He made fun of your clothes. He talked about, you know, whoever you rooted for or whatever else. And he just talked a lot of smack, you know? And that's what you loved about him because he was such a genuine person that you couldn't even really get upset. You know, you just had to be like, oh, wait, yep, that's Sekou. And the one thing, too, about him, and I've known him half my life, which is crazy to think about, is that he's the type of person that you want to be around. Because, you know, I can't think of a time that I hung out with him, whether it was like at a lunch or dinner or just any type of outing, where I didn't feel better afterward. You know, he just had a way of just lightening the mood. He had incredible sense of humor, just impeccable timing with his jokes. And you just felt better just being in his presence. And it wasn't that he necessarily needed people around him, but you were drawn to him. You were drawn to his spirit. You were drawn to his positivity. You were drawn to his energy. But he also did reach out. He was a great mentor to a lot of people. I know that when I made some career decisions, you know, I talked to Sekou about it, you know, and just to see what he thought. And the one thing that always jumped out to me was that he always supported me, you know, whatever I chose to do. And he would always give me, you know, counters, but also reasons why I was making the right decision. And so he was somebody who I trusted. And, you know, the last couple of days have been really rough, you know, because I had known that he was ill. I know he had been hospitalized. And, you know, from the moment he was hospitalized, like I probably had at least once every day, I probably wept, you know, or had to walk away to stop from crying. Cause I didn't want to lose him. And, you know, to see him, you know, gone now, it's just hard. It's hard to think that, you know, right now I wouldn't go to a finals if there is one because of COVID, but you know, last time we were together was at the All-Star in Chicago. That was the last time we hung out. I mean, obviously we talked and we've texted, you know, over that time, but to actually be around him and hang out with him, you know, it's going to be weird when we do wind up going to these events again and not having him there, not having that laugh, But yeah, Sekou's just—he's just an amazing person, and I think a lot of people are starting to, are realizing that the tributes that you've probably heard from all over the obits, the tweets, everyone has a Sekou story. They're all the same story, but they're all completely different.
Yeah.
Everyone will tell you about how much they enjoy being around him. But they'll tell you why they enjoy being around him for a different reason, because he just knew how to find common ground with anybody and everybody. If he didn't agree with you or didn't even really rock with you, you know, if he didn't really like you, you may not have known it, because he still found a way to laugh with you and to have a good time with you. And you felt good just because he made you feel good. And so I was always marveled at his ability, you know, to do that. You know, and I always was impressed with just the way players spoke to him, you know, and just the way that, you know, he just had a knack for just getting people to open up to him, but also, you know, and trust him, but also that he could bust their balls too in a quickness. And, yeah. He's going to be missed, not just by me, but by everybody who had a chance, who was fortunate enough to be around him. I'm glad that, you know, the world's getting to see just what an amazing, remarkable human being he is. But it's sad that, you know, that he's gone and I lost a part of me, because I'm going long winded. But I remember, I just added this last part last year. We just talked about Kobe. He did his Hang Time podcast for NBA TV or NBA.com, and he had me and Mark Spears get on there. And the reason why he wanted us on there was because he said he just wanted to have a conversation with his boys. Like, he didn't want to have like the typical, you know, podcast type interview where you just talk to somebody. He just wanted to have a real talk with guys who were in our 40s. You know, we're dealing with our own mortality, you know, the fact that a Kobe's gone, you know, that was devastating for all of us. I think, you know, from a certain generation, Gen Xers, you know, that was tough to see Kobe gone, because it sort of put in perspective that, wow, you know what, you really could be here today and gone tomorrow. And we had that conversation. We talked about Kobe, our reflected on him and our memories and our own personal stories with him. But we also kind of dealt with the fact that we might not be here, you know. A year later, he's not here. And, man, I loved him.
Yeah.
And I'm going to miss him.
Same. And thank you for sharing it, Michael. And beautifully said. There have been a lot of really great remembrances of him in the last couple of days. I thought Rachel Nichols did a phenomenal job on the jump yesterday, expressing both the sorrow and the anger, which is how I feel too. It is both, because this thing didn't have to get out of control the way it did. We have not handled it well as a country. So if there's anything I take away from this other than the sorrow and missing him, it is also the anger. And if you're still listening at this point in the pod, I'm not going to get lectury, but wear a mask, folks. Do the right thing. Just, you know, stay home when you can. Don't take risks. You know, the numbers are staggering, but it is when it's somebody that was that close that it really hits you. And the numbers can feel really abstract. Losing Sekou Smith is not abstract. You know, when you and you see, you know, whether it's Rachel's tribute on the jump or whether it's Adam Silver issuing a statement about a reporter, you know, like, that doesn't happen very often. Whether it's, you know, teams having moments of silence, everything that just shows you how much Sekou meant to the NBA and to all of us around this league who cover this league. But it is a reminder of how serious this pandemic is, and that everybody needs to redouble their efforts. So I will stop being lectury at this point.
Well, one thing I do want to say too is that I think it'll also, I think we did a lot of this last year, but, you know, be sure to hug the people that mean something to you.
Yeah.
Make sure you let them know you love them. Make sure you let them know they care. I'm sure Kate Sekou, I mean, I don't know if he knew how much he touched people. But I didn't even know how much he touched people until I realized that, you know, a friend of mine is trending on Twitter for, you know, a day because he impacted so many lives. But yeah, if somebody means something to you, let them know they mean something to you, and be sure to express it, because, you know, sometimes I think we take people for granted. We take them for granted that they're always going to be there. And they're not.
Yeah. Well, a time like this in a difficult week like this, nobody I'd rather spend that time with talking about it all than you, my friend. So Michael, thank you for joining us. My buddy Mannix will be back next week. We'll be back on the pod then. Thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.